How do we nurture creative, connected, resilient, emotionally intelligent, and empowered children? And they say it takes a village. So if you're feeling overwhelmed by the responsibility, you're not alone. I believe we can change the narrative for our children, but to do that, we need to change our story. Hello, it's great to have you with me. I'm Kim Clyden, former ABC radio presenter and children's book author, creating a community of people who care about children. Today's conversation carries the weight of history, and not just the kind we read about, the kind that lives, breathes, and shapes a human life. As we prepare to commemorate Anzac Day on April 25th, a day where Australians and New Zealanders pause to remember courage, endurance, sacrifice, and those who never came home. I've found myself reflecting not just on war, but on what it leaves behind. Wars don't end when the last shot is fired. They ripple through generations. They reshape countries, literally, redefine humanity, and quietly influence the values we carry forward. Commemorating the sacrifice and honouring all those who have served in wars, conflicts, and peacekeeping operations is what Anzac Day is all about. It marks the landing at Gallipoli in 1914, a moment that would come to define the Anzac spirit. Resilience, mateship, courage, in the face of unimaginable adversity. Now, I was born during the Vietnam War, a time of global unrest and shifting ideologies. In my lifetime, I've witnessed extraordinary change, both technological, cultural, and even human. My guest today was born into a world still reeling from World War II, a time of rationing, rebuilding, and the looming shadow of the atomic age. Charles Fowler has lived through decades that have defined humanity, and rather than being shaped solely by conflict, he's dedicated his life to something far more powerful: values. In his 70s, Charles is the global coordinator of World Values Day, an initiative that invites people across the world to reflect on and actively live by the values that shape our lives. But first, you need to identify them. Charles chairs the Human Values Foundation, supports global alliances for values-based education, and works across sectors to ensure that the next generation not only understand values, but lives them. Because if history has taught us anything, it's that the future depends on what we choose to pass on. Hello, Charles. It's an absolute privilege to sit with you today. Now, I want to take you back to another time in human history. Of course, the world has changed so much, even in my lifetime. But what was life like for you as a child?
Oh, as a child, it was really such a different world. I think probably for all of us, but I grew up immediately after the Second World War, and it was a time of austerity, really. I mean, immensely more austerity, I think, in the UK, which is where I live. I live now near London. I grew up not far from London, about 50 miles north of London in Bedfordshire, and it was a time of rationing. I was born, and actually, I think I just about still remember going to a shop with my mother, and my mother handing over vouchers for the food rations that we were allowed. So England was, and the whole of the UK was extremely affected by the war, both in terms of, you know, the huge effort, the loss of life, the damage, the impact that it had. But just in for a little child, for it was still a very austere time. And that, I think, had a huge impact. I mean, obviously, the impact was different from my parents' generations, who had lived through the war and, in fact, lived through just about two world wars, because when they were little, the First World War was going on. And so their lives were extraordinary, really. They were you know, just ordinary people trying to get by. But that whole feeling of struggle, of scarcity, but also, I guess, a common purpose was very much there when I was growing up. There was still that feeling of rebuilding a country. That was going on, of course, all over Europe, but very much in England, certainly in the south of England. So it was a very different world from the world that we now live in today, facing different challenges. I also grew up at a time when, you know, although it's not something I was aware of when I was very young, obviously, but a time of overshadowed by, you know, potential nuclear war for the first time in history. Man had discovered the means of wiping the human race out, and that was a big challenge. I think as I grew older, we all became aware of the threat. There was a Cuban Missile Crisis, as you know, all sorts of things where the world could have tipped into full scale nuclear war. On the Beach was published, you know, which portrayed the remnants of the human race in Australia waiting for the nuclear power to come its way. I wouldn't say one's life was overshadowed by that apprehension, that fear, but in many ways, it was something one coped with and moved on from. I'm just saying it was a very different world, really. Similar in some ways, but really radically different in many ways.
Well, that takes me to my next point, because being someone who's lived through that period where we did have those big world wars and there has been nuclear threats, how do you feel about what's happening in the world?
I think that the world is quite a frightening place. I'm not sure whether it's more frightening than it was when I was growing up, but I think certainly because we are more aware of what's going on in the world every day, I think that's the dramatic, radical difference. You know, so if you were a young child in the 1950s, you were aware of these things, but through one's parents, through radio broadcasts, looking at a newspaper. But, you know, it wasn't so omnipresent as these threats are today. So I think the divisions were huge in those days. I mean, we still have wars going on in the 1950s through to the 1960s, not as catastrophic as the First and Second World Wars, but still, you know, big conflicts in, obviously, in Korea, in Vietnam, but lots of other things going on around the world, lots of disorder, lots of division, but we weren't so aware of it. So I think that's the major difference, really. The threats here, I mean, they're new. We've still got the nuclear threat. We don't want to get too negative, but we've still got a lot of threats on us. And, you know, obviously climate change, obviously other threats to humanity, including AI, which, you know, we're all been thinking about, learning about a lot recently. And that offers, you know, on the plus side, obviously amazing potential benefits, but also, of course, potentially existential threats.
You're a huge advocate for values and civil society. So who would you say had the most influence during your formative years to help create some sense of hope and values?
Well, you know, when I was growing up, nobody uses the word values to me, or I wasn't aware of it. To be honest, I wasn't really aware of it till I got quite a lot older. Relatively recently, I'm ashamed to say, you know, it was only about maybe 25 years ago that I really started being aware of a thing called values. But yeah, the values were there. I mean, of course, whether we know it or not, whether we're conscious of them or not, we have values. That's what drives our lives. So the values that I grew up with, I think semi-consciously, but they were quite ingrained, was the values of the society that I lived in, which was really rediscovering itself after the war. So there was a lot of values to do with collaboration, cooperation, building a new society, rebuilding. All of that was there in the background. But I guess, like any children, my influences were very much from my parents and my family initially. My father had, and my mother had, quite a, I wouldn't say a very tough upbringing, but they'd had one, quite apart from the world wars, they'd had one that was challenging. My father had health problems from a young man. He was a very active, sporty young man, but then got tuberculosis, lost a lung, And that created big problems. You know, if you know, in those days, there was no easy cure for tuberculosis. So he survived, but with a body which was somewhat frail. But he led a normal life. My mother, against her family's advice, married him notwithstanding, and they brought up four children. And he was not able to participate in the Second World War, but he did a lot of civic work during that time, fire watching and all these things. And my mother too. Both of them were very rooted, I'd say, in lots of traditional values and good ones. I mean, to do with helping each other, very community minded. My mother in particular, she had four children, and then at the age of about 40, she really looked around and thought, what am I doing with my life? And I talked to her a lot about this when I was older. And she really devoted her life to community work, to community service. She got into all sorts of voluntary work, looking after sick people, looking after elderly people, all sorts of different organizations, which she gradually gravitated towards. And her whole time, I remember from the age where I was about five years old onwards, really being just, my father was out to work all day, but she was out doing this, that, and the other, always off to meetings, always doing some sort of volunteering. And she got into politics. She was not party political, but she was very keen to help local communities. She served for many, many years on the local town council, the borough council, and was mayor for a while. She served on the county council, which is the sort of next grade up. And she did, in the meantime, all these other things. When she got really quite old, she was still popping out. She said, I've got to go and see the old people now, she would say, when she was about, 80 years old. And so she'd be still working at it. So that was the sort of, I guess these are the sort of values that were unconsciously passed on to me, that you do what you can for others. It sounds all a little bit biased to be saying that, but it's really, I think, the I don't know whether that's the value shared by everyone, but I don't think that was unusual. I do think there was a time when, perhaps as a result of the World War, that people really pulled together, and a time of a lot of community cohesion and community spirit, I think. People knew each other, they helped each other. And I think, was that rosy-tinted hindsight? I don't think so. I think that was my experience, really, as I was growing up. So I think that's where I came from. My mother was a great influence. Immediately after the war, we're talking a lot about the war, so sorry about that, but that was a formative influence, I think, on those generations that grew up, obviously during the war, but after the war as well. And I admire people who had the courage to fight in the war. I mean, that was just such a challenge. My grandfather was killed in action in the First World War. My father grew up with just a mother, as a one parent family, without any great means to support themselves. So it was quite tough. So that background, I think, of overcoming difficulties was very much there.
How much of that was passed on to your children and theirs?
Well, I think this is, something that one without really thinking about it, without being conscious, this is very much passed on to the next generations. I think that's the case with all of us. We absorb the values of our parents or our immediate family, not necessarily parents, but whoever, was most active in our upbringing, our peers, the society we grew up in. Of course, all of that is absorbed. And I guess I was lucky to have an upbringing where, looking back on it, I didn't articulate this at all at the time, the values were very solid and very evident. I personally went through a period where I grew up, came through my teens in the 1960s and very early 70s. And that was a period of, what they call the counterculture, which was a little bit of a dramatization of what was going on at the time. But there was a big pushback against, I guess, what we'd call now the values of our parents, previous generations. There's a pushback, against what we were just talking about, austerity and, a certain rigidity in society too. And So I was also a creature of that, and I was a very active teenager, looking at, thinking about things, thinking deeply about society and about what I'm, and I was very much, I guess, feeling things needed to change. And so there was a sort of spirit of rebellion, if you like, in the air then as well. But we were actually pushing back against something that was, I think, very deep-rooted and solid and rooted in our human nature, which was, you know, for all the perhaps rigidity of society in those days, there were a lot of very, very good positive values that were held there. And was, I think, you know, that pushback was necessary. But I think that in many ways that our upbringings led us to it. You know, we were brought up with, as previous generations obviously must have been as well, with a feeling that, you know, we needed to change the world for the better. So I think that was a big, big feeling around when I was growing up. I think every generation probably has it. It's more to do with one's age than the particular period that one lives in. But so we all want to change the world. And then we sort of get bound up, wrapped up in earning a living, and we get distracted by the practicalities of actually embarking on life outside the comfort, if you're lucky to have comfort of a safe upbringing. And that certainly was the case with me. I think that, you know, I got bound up in a career. I became a lawyer. I practiced the law for a while, and then I went into the financial world, and I was involved in all sorts of exciting things to do with emerging markets, investing in emerging markets around the world. I started traveling all over the world to Australia quite a lot, but all around the Pacific Rim, all around Southeast Asia, Northeast Asia, throughout you know, the rest of the world, really, Central Asia, Eastern Europe, as it started opening up. So it's all a time of huge change and dramatic change, actually, in many parts of the world, socially, economically, and culturally, as globalization then took hold. I was really, really quite bound up in this, the intellectual challenge, the excitement, finding out new things, finding out new places, traveling around the world. I mean, constantly traveling around the world for quite a number of years. So I think that the sort of idea about changing society, creating a better world, was there. And I think, you know, I materially it was becoming a better world. So I guess one felt, okay, the world is getting better. But what I came to realize after a while, as I moved through life, was one needs to actually, in many ways, go back to basics. And I think that's what happens as you get a bit older and you start thinking about what really matters. And, okay, material comfort does matter. I mean, it's a matter of life and death for a lot of people around the world still. So that's going to still be top priority for a lot of people. But nevertheless, even for whoever you are, whatever your material conditions, there's clearly more to life than just putting a roof over your head, your family's head, earning a living of some kind. So I think that's what I came round to. So I eventually sort of, I guess, rediscovered the ethos, if you like, as I, you know, got older, and particularly when I started to think about values, and I got sort of, as it were, explicitly introduced to values. And that didn't really happen until I was in my 40s. Up until then, I had no idea that you could really, that values were a thing, you know, something that you could be and should be conscious about, really.
Well, you do need to identify them, you know, formally for you to live them as well, because I realised in my 40s that I hadn't verbalised or confirmed what my values were to myself. I knew how they felt, but I hadn't actually identified what those values were. And it's shaped my life from then on, because I now know why I feel an affinity with some people and why it's easier to connect with some people than it is with others. It's all based in our values and our perceptions. So why did you feel it was necessary to start a movement like World Values Day?
Well, it's a long story, but it's a very simple one, really. I was, you know, very active in the financial world, doing very well. I was chairing quite a big investment company, and I was introduced to a charity, small charity based in the UK, which used values explicitly as a way of helping children to learn about themselves and, how to understand themselves, how to understand their own emotions, how to understand, how to relate well and healthily to other children and adults as well. And really the whole personal development thing, it's such an important part of children's education, but often it's sort of taken for granted that somehow by a process of osmosis, somehow children will learn how, learn all this stuff, which to some extent works, but it's very hit and miss. So what I realized is that you could do it quite systematically. And that's what really amazed me. So I was asked to help out with this charity helping to raise some money. And I gradually understood what they were doing. And I, sitting in the back of classrooms, as I was allowed to do from time to time, watching these, sometimes very tiny children talk about values, really using a simple vocabulary, but it's just a way of enabling them to talk about themselves and having understanding and perceptions. And as you, I'm sure, know, it's just amazingly how children take to these sort of deep discussions. You could never really imagine that they would be able to talk to each other with very little prompting, just maybe a story or some suggestions or a song. And they just take to it like ducks to water. And I was really impressed by this. But it took me a long time to realize that actually values were not only important for children, but, they're absolutely what drove the rest of us, what drove our behavior, our choices, our big life choices, our small life choices, all the stuff that we do. And often these choices are made, unconsciously, and we end up in places where we don't want to go, really. We find ourselves in positions of stress, anxiety. And actually, looking back at it now, I can see where I went wrong in my life, where I did stupid things or made the wrong choices. I can see it's because those choices weren't aligned with my values. I had no idea really what my values were. They were there, but I just wasn't aware of them. It was all catalyzed by a big survey that was done in the UK. It's the same survey has been done, I think, in Australia, in Canada, in the US, in about 40 countries around the world. And the survey looks at a cross-section of the population, a demographically balanced cross-section. And the questions that are asked are essentially, what are your values? And people come up with, in the UK, it was the top values: family, caring, honesty, compassion, respect, these amazing values. And this is about two-thirds of the population. Actually, whichever country you're in, it's pretty much the same. Slightly different words, slightly different order, different cultures, different faith backgrounds, different parts of the world. They come up with all those wonderful values, and my goodness, isn't that wonderful? And then they're asked about the values of the community they live in, and they're still pretty good. And then they're asked, well, what about the society you're living in, the country you're living in? What's going on there? What do you think about? And they come out with, it's like day and night. Suddenly they come out with all these other words: blame, bureaucracy, corruption, conflict, violence. All these totally agonizing words come out. And I was invited along to come and join a crowd who had been involved in this survey. And everyone was thinking, we must do something about it. Isn't this a tragedy, really? And it's a real call to action, we felt. Here it is, apparently, and this is news to me, apparently people have these wonderful positive ideas. Most people have these wonderful positive values, and yet we're living in a society where those values obviously aren't being expressed. If they were, we wouldn't see the sort of society that we see. And that was really what lay behind that formation of an organization in the UK called the UK Values Alliance, which I joined, and for the last, 10, 12 years have been helping to run. And when we got together, and it's amazing. You know, I was really amazed by the number of people who were involved with values. I thought I'd sort of, there were a few of us sort of, you know, trying to wave the flag for values in the educational sector, you know, and it all was seemed very, very, very difficult going. I mean, hard to get people's attention. People didn't seem to want to talk about values. Had we got, you know, was there something wrong with this? This concept, you know, we were losing heart in a way. And then I discovered all these people who had come together, attracted, I guess, by, you know, the survey and discovering, you know, what, each other for the first time, discovering there was this big potential network of people. A lot of people using values in life coaching. That whole positive psychology movement, I think, has generated a lot of awareness about values, which I didn't really understand at the time, but that's what I discovered. And they're using life coaching in organizational consultancies, you know, corporate transformation work, leadership training. So people using all this stuff all the time. And that was a big, big, big incentive to really get out there and try and change. And we found the same thing around the world. We started realizing all around the world, it was the same story. And that was how we got to launch World Values Day. We just really wanted to bring people together so that together we could all raise our voices and talk about and you know, just draw attention to values and the immense importance of values in all of our lives and the fact that we don't really understand that and how important it is to put those values into action in the end and change the world by doing so, building a better world. So that was really the call to action. That's what we're trying to do with World Values Day.
Well, you've got me on board, Charles, and I'm really looking forward to sinking my teeth into some of this and hopefully spreading the word. Thank you so much for getting up so early in the UK to join us on What We Teach Our Children. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I think we'll have to do this again.
I'd love to do it again, Kim. It's such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much. It's very kind of you to have me on, and thank you for organizing this whole thing, and thank you for your wonderful podcast too.
That's Charles Fowler, Global Coordinator of World Values Day, and you'll find more information about that in the show notes, or just search World Values Day to find the website. In a world that has known so much conflict, division and loss, this is a reminder that life is precious. And not just human life, but all living beings we share this planet with. If we lose sight of that, we stop valuing one another. And we'll move closer to something none of us truly want to see. Disconnection, division, even chaos. But there is another way. It lives in the choices we make every day. How we speak to each other. How we listen. How we teach our children to see the world and each other. And that's for us to set an example. We don't need to agree on everything. We do need to remember what connects us. Until we're together again, let's be the change we want to see in the world.